Robertson Janis from Catholic Apologetics International, and we're continuing our series on the topic of justification, not by faith alone. In our last session, we went through the book of James, and we're going to continue on with the book of James and getting into even more detail about the finer points of James' arguments using Abraham and Rahab. In James chapter 2, verse 24, it says that Abraham was justified not by faith alone, but by works. Now, what some people try to do with this passage is to change some of the words and their meanings to fit the theology that they're proposing. One of the things that is done is to change the meaning of the word justified to vindicated or something that Abraham just demonstrated. And what we mean by that is this. The theory is that Abraham was justified at one point in time, once for all, never to be repeated in Genesis 15, when he believed that God was going to give him a son, and God said to Abraham, because of that faith, you are righteous before me. And that's what's understood as his justification. Anything that comes after that is considered the fruit of Abraham's faith. And that's why he could do the work of sacrificing Isaac on the mountain in Genesis 22. That sacrifice of Isaac was not considered a justification. It's considered a vindication of Abraham's previous justification, or a demonstration of Abraham's previous justification. Now, that concept is not biblical. It is very wrong, and that's not what James is trying to tell us. As we have said before in these sessions on James, James is teaching us that faith and works work together at each point in Abraham's life. And when he does those faith and works already from Genesis 12, 13, 14, and all the way up to Genesis 22, at each point he is credited with righteousness and justified. Because as the Council of Trent taught us, our justification is a progression of justification. We increase in justification throughout our lives until we are finally justified at the end, in the end time judgment, and ready to take our place as a citizen in the kingdom of heaven. Now, there are many technical arguments we can get into to try to unravel this. What I do suggest is that if you have a chance to pick up the book Not by Faith Alone, and there are about 75 pages on this topic of James, when we get into the technical arguments showing that this is not true. One of them that I will give you, however, is this. James quotes from Genesis 15, verse 6, and he says that Abraham believed God and was counted to him as righteousness, or that Abraham was justified because of that belief. Now, this means that James has the same definition of righteousness and justification that Paul does. Why? Because Paul, earlier in Romans chapter 4, had quoted from the same verse in Genesis 15, 6, that Abraham believed God and he was justified because of that belief. So if James is quoting the same verse that Paul is quoting, then we must understand that James has the same understanding, the same definitions of terms that Paul does. So if that is the case, then why would someone want to change the next use of the word justification in the next verse of James chapter 2, verse 24, to say that it didn't mean justification, it meant a vindication? You see, that would be incongruous. Because James has already told us in the previous verse that he understands justification exactly like Paul does, because he quotes from the same verse in the Old Testament. So it's not logical that he would change his definition. Now, that's one very technical argument, and there are many more technical arguments that we can get into. One way that this proposal is supported by our non-Catholic brethren is to say that the word justified does not always mean justified, that sometimes it can mean vindicated. And there's one passage in the New Testament that they point to, and there is only one passage that will even suggest that possibility, and that's in Matthew 11, verse 19. Now, John Calvin, the staunch reformer, had used this very verse to try to prove his point, to claim that James was using the word justified in a different way than Paul was. And in this verse, Jesus says, "And wisdom is justified by her works." Okay? Or the same companion passage in Luke 7:35 reads, "And wisdom is justified by all her children." Now, the proposed argument is that these passages are using justified in the sense of vindication or demonstration, not as a salvific justification. But we respond to this in this way. Matthew 11:19 and Luke 7:35 are not using justified in the same way that James is, because Matthew 11:19 and Luke 7 are poetic contexts. And because they're poetic contexts, in other words, wisdom can't be justified because it's an abstract virtue. It can't be justified like a man. And so it can't be using the same definition of the word justified. But that's the only place in the whole New Testament where we find this instance. And it's in a section of poetry. Now, we do the same thing when English authors or American authors write poetry. They take a word that normally means something in English, and then when they put it in a poetic context, the meaning changes. For example, if I say I eat an apple, everyone knows what an apple is. They have a picture of a red apple in their mind. But if I say you're the apple of my eye, you're not going to automatically think of your eye holding an apple. We're using the term apple much differently when it's in a poetic context. And the meaning must change a little bit in order to accommodate the poetry, because the poetry is supposed to give a different meaning, you see. Now, that's the only reason that Matthew and Luke use the word justified in that sense, because they can't use it in the normal literal sense because they're in a poetic context. So, another thing we must say about this also, Matthew 11 and Luke 7, where Jesus says wisdom is justified by her children, are not contexts dealing with salvation and damnation. But James chapter 2 is. As a matter of fact, we saw in our last session that the whole book of James, from chapters 1 to 5, is dealing with the issue of salvation and damnation. And whenever the word justified is used in context dealing with salvation and damnation, it is the same meaning that Paul uses, because Paul also uses that word in context of salvation and damnation to be referring to salvation. Is the man justified before God or not? So it is a fallacious argument to say that the one time that this word justified is used, it changes its definition, so we can transport that definition back to James and make James say something different than what Paul is saying. But that is a fallacy. Now, one of the more interesting arguments that James uses besides Abraham is the character of Rahab. Now, Rahab was an Old Testament figure who was prominent in the conquest of Jericho. The Israelites had just come out of Egypt. They were traveling through the desert, and they were to destroy the land of Canaan and take it over for themselves. It was a land flowing with milk and honey. They met this prostitute, Rahab, and Rahab bargained with the Israelite soldiers that if they would save her and her family, that she would hide them from the people in Jericho who were trying to capture the Israelites. And she did just that. She hid the spies, and when the people of Jericho came to find out where they were, she told them that they went out another way, and thereby she saved the Israelite soldiers from being killed. And for that, James says that was an act of righteousness. And because of that act of righteousness in hiding the spies, she was justified for that. And James is using that example. Now, this is interesting because, number one, as we said before in our last session, James is trying to educate the Jew to his own law, because the Jew had used the law. He had thought because he was circumcised and doing all his rituals that was his ticket to heaven. That's how he was justified. And he propped up Abraham as the example of that, because Abraham was circumcised and I'm circumcised. Well, that means that we're both going to go to heaven. Both Paul and James have to reinterpret Abraham for the Jew and show them, no, it wasn't because of Abraham's circumcision. It was because of who Abraham was throughout his life, and that was the reason why he was justified. And so that's the first thing he does. Then he goes to another person, Rahab, who no one who, being a Jew, would normally think that a person like this could be saved. After all, she's a prostitute. And more than that, she's not even a Jew. So how can she be justified? But yet, she's justified in the very context in the Old Testament when the Jews are trying to conquer the land of Canaan. And they're the people of God. I mean, God had put 10 devastating plagues on the Egyptians, showing his power and showing what a great people the Jews were. And yet, during that very time was the time that this Gentile prostitute was justified by her works. Again, what James is trying to do is show that the Jews were not performing the works that God wanted them to do, that it was a Gentile who was performing those works, and it was the Gentile who received the salvation. And this is even more pertinent in the fact that of all the people that had left Egypt of the Jews and traveled through the desert, only two of them made it to the land of Canaan, Joshua and Caleb. All the other adults, and there were almost 2 million of those adults who had left Egypt by this time, because there were 600,000 men who had left Egypt, not counting women and children. All of them died in the desert for unbelief, and only Joshua and Caleb made it to the land of Canaan. And so when they finally come into the land of Canaan, again, they get a slap in the face, because here's a Gentile prostitute who's being justified by her works, showing again that it's not the works of the law, it's works of faith. In Hebrews 11, verse 31, and this is interesting because we see the same thing of Rahab that we had seen of Abraham. In Hebrews 11, 31, it says, by faith, Rahab sent the spies off so that the Jews would not be killed. But James says it's her work. He calls it a work in that she sent the spies off. So again, we have Paul in Hebrews saying it's an act of faith, and James in James 2:25 saying it's a work that she's doing. We saw the same thing last time when we dealt with Abraham. When Abraham offered Isaac on the altar, the book of Hebrews in Hebrews 11:17 through 19 says this was a great act of faith. James says it was a work that he did. And so what the New Testament is trying to tell us is that faith and works were working together in attempting to sacrifice Isaac. The same thing is true of Rahab. It's her faith and works working together. Now, the most interesting part about Rahab's justification is this. In Rahab's justification, in the account of Joshua chapter 2, there's no demarcation between the time she has faith and the works that she does. They happen simultaneously. Because before the Israelites had come, Rahab was a prostitute and in sin, practicing her trade. And she says, all the people in the land of Jericho are fearing because they know that God has sent you to destroy us. Now, none of those people in Jericho had repented of their sins. Rahab is the only one. She's the only one who bows the knee to the God of Israel. And that's the moment she changes her life and has faith in God, believing that God is the judge. But that's also the time that she has her works. Now, why is this important? Because if Rahab's justification is predicated upon the fact that she has faith and works at the same time, that means that Abraham's justification has to be the same thing. Why? Because if we read the text, after James describes Abraham's justification, he says this, in the same way Rahab was justified. In other words, James is saying that Rahab's justification is the same kind of justification that Abraham had. If they were different, then we'd have two plans of salvation. But James says, no, they're identical. Now remember that James had said in Genesis 22, when Isaac was being offered by Abraham as a sacrifice, that was a justification. Now we see why he calls that a justification. Because it was an act of faith and works, and he says that that's the same thing that happened to Rahab. Her act of faith and works working simultaneously together was a justification for her. Now remember, this is also important because our non-Catholic brethren say, no, James is not saying that Abraham was justified in Genesis 22 because he was already justified at Genesis 15, you see, when he had faith in God because he believed God would give him the son. So in sacrificing Isaac on the altar in Genesis 22, that's not a justification, that's just a vindication. That's just a demonstration that he's already been justified. But see, that won't work with Rahab. Why? Because there's no point of Rahab having faith a few years earlier and then having her works. The faith and works happen simultaneously at the same time. And isn't that exactly what we said about Abraham in Genesis 22? Because Hebrews 11 says that his offering of Isaac was an act of faith, and James says it was a work. Again, we have the same thing, the faith and works working together. Now, we're going to shift gears a little bit here, and we're going to go into the teaching of Jesus on justification. First, we covered Paul in the first four sessions, and then we covered James in these next two sessions, and now we're going to go to Jesus. And we're going to divide the teaching of Jesus up into two components. The first is what he actually did on the cross for us. Because we talk about being saved by faith and justified and doing our works. How is this all possible? How was the road laid out for us to have faith in God when we were sinners? You see, how can God accept our faith and our works? Well, there's a very big reason why. And that reason is because of what Christ did. Now, that's the first thing we'll cover in this session today. And then in the next session, we'll get into the actual teaching of Jesus on justification, which in itself is very important. So we're covering Paul, James, and then Jesus. And then we'll get into the more technical aspects of justification in our later sessions. But what did Christ do for us on the cross? How is it possible that I can be saved? Well, the first thing we need to understand is that when Adam and Eve were created, God had already set up a law, a principle, a rule, that whatever Adam and Eve did, it would affect the whole human race. That was a principle that God established long before he had created the world. And Adam knew that, and Eve knew that. They knew that if they sinned, it would affect everyone, and everyone would receive the curse of sin and death. And that's what makes that sin so heinous, is that they knew that it would affect everyone. Now, by that same principle, however, Christ can be our Savior, because just like Adam and Eve's sin would affect everyone, Christ's righteousness would affect everyone. And you see, so it's not so bad that Adam and Eve's sin affects everyone, because Christ's righteousness is not just for himself. That will affect everyone, and that's exactly the way God used it. That's called the law of representation, where one man represents a whole group. Adam was our federal head and represented us all before God. And because Adam sinned, God's rule required that that sin would be passed down to all the progeny of Adam. But likewise, the righteousness of Christ would be passed down to all those who believe. And that is covered by Paul in Romans chapter 5. Now, what we have to understand also is that in the sin of Adam, he had destroyed the relationship that God had set up. And it's that whole relationship that has to be repaired. Adam did not please God. Christ came as the second Adam to please God. But there's a special way in which Christ had to please God. And that's what we need to read about here. What did Christ's suffering and death actually accomplish that allowed the Father to provide the human race with salvation? Did Christ take within himself the sin and guilt of mankind and suffer the specific punishment for that sin and guilt? Now, this is what our Protestant brethren contend, that Christ, as he died on the cross, died and paid the price for our sins, so that we can now be imputed with his righteousness, not our own righteousness, and thereby, by Christ's righteousness, we can be justified and go to heaven. And the only way that can happen is if Christ pays for the sins. Now, is that what Christ did? Is that what Catholic theology teaches us? No, it doesn't teach us that Christ paid for every last sin. It says that Christ died, and because of that, he opens up the pathway for us to get back to God. But he didn't legally pay for our sin, because if that was the case, then no one would have to go to hell. If a payment has already been made for sin, then there's no punishment left for sin. The guilty should be set free, you see. So our Catholic theology says, no, it wasn't an actual payment, a legal payment. It was a sacrifice that Christ did. And that's why we have the sacrifice of the Mass. It was a sacrifice that Christ performed to appease the wrath of the Father so that he would again relent of his wrath and open up the pathway of salvation again that was closed in the time of Adam. That's what really happened. And we read about this in Scripture. It says in Ephesians 5, verse 2, that Christ loved us and gave himself up for us as a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. Now that's interesting. A fragrant offering, that's the language that was used in the Old Testament when they were performing sacrifices for God, when they sacrificed the bull or the lamb or whatever it was. That smoke of the offering went up, and God smelled the offering, as it says in Leviticus chapter 5, and it was a sweet aroma in his nostrils. In John chapter, in 1 John chapter 2, verse 2, it states this: He is the atoning sacrifice or propitiation for our sins, and not only for ours, but also for the sins of the whole world. Now here, again, we have that word, propitiation or atoning sacrifice. That's what Christ did. He became a sacrifice to us. And this is very important to us as Catholics, because our whole understanding of theology is wrapped around the sacrifice of Christ, not only at the cross, but also at the Mass. Now, the reason there must be a sacrifice is this. As we said before many times, God must remain holy and honorable in his dealings with men. He cannot merely excuse the sin of man. God must first be appeased for the sin of man. According to God's principles, only the blood of an innocent victim would be accepted as an atonement, as an appeasement for his wrath. Christ, because he was guiltless, sin-free, and in favor with God, could offer himself up as a means of appeasing God in order to have God relent of his wrath against the sins of mankind. Sin is a personal offense against God. God is not some unemotional courtroom judge who is unaffected by the sin of man. We said before that God is personally insulted and offended at the sin of man. And because God is personally offended by sin, he demands to be personally appeased in order to offer man a personal forgiveness. And a great satisfaction was necessary since man had sinned against a great and holy God. This dramatic plan is stated no better than in Isaiah chapter 53, verses 10 to 12. Listen to these fascinating words of the prophet Isaiah. Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him, that's Christ, it was the Lord's will to crush Christ, and cause him to suffer. And though the Lord makes his life a guilt offering, after the suffering of his soul, that is Christ's soul, he, that is God, will see the result of the suffering of his soul and be satisfied. For he bore the sin of many and made intercession for the transgressors. Now you see a lot of words that Isaiah uses here. God says that it was his will to crush Christ, to watch him suffer. And because of the suffering of Christ, God is satisfied. In other words, God is appeased. His wrath is dissipated, because this perfect victim offered himself up freely and voluntarily and stood in between the condemned sinner and the righteous and holy God and said, accept my sacrifice for their sins. May I appease your wrath. And that's why Isaiah says he was the intercessor for the transgressors. In his mediatorial role, Christ, living a sinless life and dying a selfless death, obtains favor from God so that he can approach and beseech him for mercy and forgiveness on behalf of sinful man. God is not required to offer forgiveness, yet Christ's sacrifice appeals to the intrinsic love and long-suffering of God. Christ, as the obedient Son who sacrifices himself, intercedes to obtain mercy from the Father for those who are going to be adopted into God's family. From his paternal qualities of pity and love, the Father grants an avenue of forgiveness for all mankind. So you see, what Christ did was not pay for the sins of mankind, Because if there was a payment made, nobody would have to pay another price for those sins. No one would go to hell. The price that Christ paid was the price that it cost him to open up the pathway for God to offer salvation to all of mankind. And that's why we as Catholics don't believe that salvation is only for a certain group of people. No, as 1 John chapter 2, verse 1 says, the propitiation of Christ, the sacrifice of Christ, was for the whole world, so that anyone has the opportunity to come to Christ, whether he's the lowest tribal member in Africa to the man in New York City. Well, whoever it is, everyone has the same opportunity to come to Christ, because that sacrifice was the price that was paid to open up the pathway, not to pay for each man's sins. And as we saw in Isaiah, very important passage, that God desired this appeasement. Why? Because God is a holy and honorable being. He cannot excuse the sin of man. Therefore, there has to be a great sacrifice to make him feel better about the whole situation. And why? Because God is a personal being. God is personally affected by sin. He is involved in it, and he's insulted when men sin. And because he's insulted, he needs to be appeased for that sin. And that's why Christ came to do what he did. In our next session, we'll go into this even in more detail. Thank you very much.